Good morning. Thank you for inviting us to come and share this morning. It's a special, we're driving across Canada from BC, sharing about Seeds of Hope. And this is a special stop for us because we have Alice and Rick McLeod, who are very dear friends who have moved this way, that are here this morning with us. And also our pastor from BC is also here. So Dan and Linda and his wife. I wanted to say, you know, Samaritan's Purse does so much more than shoeboxes. It is such a great ministry. Samaritan's Purse, we are a partner of Samaritan's Purse, and Samaritan's Purse actually built our wall fence in Africa for our orphanage. They also built a house in the back where we house some of our staff. They built our security wall. They built our cafeteria, and they also built one of the dormitories you're going to see in our home in Myanmar. So you can see that they have really blessed our ministry and enabled us to care for thousands of children. If you're interested, while John's setting us, we have a CD of our kids that's available in the back. And this book is written about one of our kids. She came to Canada for surgery. Her name is Makuba, and while she was here, she was homeschooled. And the lady who homeschooled her, she kept hearing her story and started journaling it. And then she asked her if she would mind if she wrote it. So this is actually a true story of one of the kids in our home. A few of the facts have been changed just to protect her. Can I go?
Here we go.
So we have four, Seeds of Hope has four children's homes in total. We have two in Myanmar and two in Zambia. Myanmar is a closed country. It's very hard to work there. It is military rule. It used to be called Burma, for those of you that don't know. And both Canada and United States have embargoes against Myanmar. So therefore, it's very hard to give. It's very hard to work in that country. But Seeds of Hope applied for special status to be able to legally give money to Myanmar. And we were one of the few charities that was granted this special status so that we can give. Our homes in Burma, however, are not known by the Burmese government. They're underground. So everything we take in, it has to be done underground. Seeds of Hope, our first objective is to raise children to love and serve God. And our second objective is to give them the tools to be whatever God's called them to be. So in Myanmar, we try to keep the home hidden and very rustic. It's for HIV-positive children. And this is the home. We have 13 children now. And this is the home that Samaritan's Purse actually just built for us. And it's on the same property. And it has it's for our girls. And then the boys are in the other structure. This is the beds. Like I said, it's nothing fancy, but they have a great life. They learn about Jesus. It's 100% nationally run. And they do go to school. However, the school just doesn't know they're positive because HIV kids in Burma are not allowed to go to school. These are our kids having craft time. And this is Nancy. This is how our kids come to us. People say, how do you get kids if you're not known by the government? We are starting to get to known among the churches in Myanmar. And one of the pastors knew about this family where the parents had died, and there was a handicapped girl caring for her younger sister. And the younger sister was really sick and not getting well. So they said, would you consider taking her? So we tested her and she was HIV positive. And so we've accepted her into PGH. And that is her now. You can see the difference in the blue dress, blue and white dress. And then there was another home that the Burmese people wanted us to see there. They said, would you come and see this home? Because it's run so well and it will help you run your home. So we went to see, it was called Justina Home, and it was run by a pastor who had gone to school in India, so he was very educated. And when I met him, I said to John, you know, he has the closest vision to Seeds of Hope than anyone I've met in 16 years. His first objective was also to raise children to love and serve God, and his second objective was to break the cycle of poverty through education. So, and his, I sat down with him, and I asked him where he gets his support, and he said, just through well-wishers, God supplies it, they grow flowers. So I said to him, well, you know, we have some extra cash on this trip, we'd like to bless you, is there something you need? And he said, a generator. He said, so our kids could study in the evening. This is where his kids sleep. And instead of having a living room, he doesn't have a living room, he doesn't have a kitchen, he has a library. The one room they have, they've made a library. And you can see he's proudly displayed all his children's awards. That's how, you know, how focused they are on education. And I said to Nadim, because he has two biological girls, I said, Nadim, where do your own children sleep? And he said, with the rest of my kids. And that really touched my heart. And I said to John, we really need to get involved. He has no other support except for what he sells from his flowers. So Seeds of Hope has now taken on this second home. But our largest project is in Zambia. And Zambia is a country totally impoverished. It is, life expectancy is 33 years old. It's at 80% unemployment, and less than 50% of children get to go to school. But God has blessed us with this beautiful property. It's 60 acres. And we also have a property in town that's 1 acre where we keep our kids until they reach 6 years old, and then they go to Grace Academy. We decided to open a boarding school instead of an orphanage, because in Zambia, wealthy kids actually go to boarding school. And we wanted to, there's an unspoken caste system in Zambia, and orphans are on the bottom. And so HIV orphans are even below them. So we thought, why not open a boarding school instead of an orphanage and break that stigma? So we opened Grace Academy, the first boarding school in the world for HIV children. This is the village. This is where our kids live. There's 8 dormitories and 2 dorm parents per house. So each house has 6 bedrooms. So we only have 2 kids per bedroom, a set of bunk beds, a wardrobe, and they each have their own desks, and then a room for each dorm parent. If you want to know what it's like to be a dorm parent, Danae and Julia were there as dorm parents. And this is our elementary school. When we first started Grace Academy or Buseko Home in Zambia in the year 2000, it was actually a home where children would go to die being loved and cared for because they were HIV positive. But in 2005, we were able to get the drugs, the antiretroviral drugs that HIV people take. So now a person taking these drugs and living a healthy lifestyle can now live a normal lifespan. I mean, that's amazing. So now we thought, oh, we have to get a future for these children. How are we going to do it? I mean, with the schools there, there's 60 to 90 kids per classroom. And when we brought Makuba here for that surgery I told you about, she couldn't read and she was in grade 5. And when she was here, we realized she couldn't read because there were no books in the classrooms. They have usually 1 to 2 pencils per class that they just pass around. So we thought, if we are going to break the cycle of poverty, then we have to give the kids a good education. So we decided to build our own school. So this is our elementary school. And this here is just an overlay of the school. So we've actually divided our property into 3. And so the first you saw, which was the village, which is 2 acres. It's wall fenced separately. And then this is our school side. This is our new secondary school, and it's going to be opened in January. The school year in Zambia goes from January to December, so this will be opened in January. The building on the left is the high school, and the building on the left is all of our labs. It's our science wing, our home economics wing, our music wing, and our library and computer labs. And this is our basketball court and our tennis court. And this is Helen, and I really wanted to share Helen's story because so many people come to us and say, John actually had gone to a foundation in Ontario, and they said to him, you know, we think your goals are unrealistic. They said, you're never going to make a change in Africa. We should just feed them, you know, and leave them alone. They said, why are you changing things for them? And John said, because I believe that we need to raise them to love and serve God. It is only Christ that is going to change that nation. And this is Helen. And we got Helen when she was younger, her and her sister, and she has 2 twin brothers with us. And Helen came in. Here's a girl who was broken. I can't tell you her story, it's very personal, but she was abused beyond comprehension. And she came in broken, and she's accepted Christ. Her life has been totally transformed. And she just wrote, in Zambia, they write grade 7, 9, and 12 exams, and she just wrote her grade 9 exams, and her and three out of our 9 kids that wrote placed in the top 3 in the entire district, not in the area, in the district. And they got chosen in pure sciences, which means in Zambia that you are the cream of the crop. They call them the cream of the crop. That they scored so high on the exams that they can choose any school in the entire country that they want to go to. And so Helen was one of those. Aggie and Elias are the other ones. One wants to be a doctor and one wants to be an engineer. I said to Aggie, so why a doctor? What made you pick a doctor? You could have been anything. And she said, because I really believe I can serve God in Zambia being a doctor. And this is where we're building, because as you see, we can only take in, we have 8 dormitories, we have 106 children now and 63 staff. And the need is so great in Zambia. I said to John, like, we're turning kids away. How can that be right? So we decided to build another 8 dormitories or children's homes on this side. So we've just broke ground and we're building 8 more children's homes so we can bring in 64 more kids. This is how most of our kids come to us. They are emaciated, in very bad shape. Most of them have not started the antiretroviral drugs yet, so they're very sick. Contrary to what most people think, orphans are not unloved children, that parents just come and drop them off or dump them. That does happen, but in most cases, parents really love their kids, and they can't care for them for whatever reason. In Carl's case, his mom was very sick, and she came to us, and she said, please take my son, she said, because I'm going to die, and I just need to know he's being loved and cared for. I think any parent here can know that that would be such a peace to you if you had no one. And she passed away 2 days after we brought him in. But this is Carl now, and you can see that God has really transformed his life. I have to tell you, he looks really cute here, but he is the naughtiest child we have. Out of the 106 kids we have, he is 106. He is the naughtiest, so he looks so cute. And this is Mercy. We found Mercy in the local market there, and I'm sure Julie and Danae can remember shopping in that market in Missala. And that's where we found Mercy. And what drew her to us was her shoes. We were trying to figure out how she was keeping those shoes on her feet when they had no fronts, no backs, and no sides. And at the same time, she was actually balancing those sweet potatoes on her head. So we took her photo, and I just saw that emptiness in her eyes. She had this hollowness. And so I decided, you know what? We need to help this little girl. You can't just take a picture of her. So we asked around the market, and we found out that she was actually what they call a dumped child. So she was abandoned in the market when she was a toddler. And at the end of the day, the marketeers would just feed her their scraps. When she was old enough to sell sweet potatoes, an elderly lady said to her, I will be your guardian. I'll let you live at my house if you sell these sweet potatoes for me. So that's how Mercy got her first job, and she became known as a sweet potato girl. So I went to this guardian and I said, could I please pay for Mercy to go to school? And she was so excited. She said, yes, of course, but she can't go without a school uniform. So I went to the market and I got the material, got a tailor, and I had, you know, everything, her socks, shoes, you know, right down to the panties. She had nothing. So I got her a school uniform made, and I went back a few days later to the guardian and I had the school uniform. I said, where's Mercy? And she said, she's not here. She's at school. I said, at school? I thought she couldn't go to school without a school uniform. She said, no, she's not in school. She's at school. Ever since she found out she gets to go to school, she's been sitting outside the school wall. So we brought Mercy home, and we back to the guardian's house, and I gave her the school uniform, and we went to the school. And like I said, there's an unspoken caste system. So when I tried to get her registered at the school, the principal said, she can't come to this school. I said, why can't she come? He said, well, she doesn't even have a birthday. She doesn't even know how old she is. I said, Mercy, would you like to be 7, 8, or 9? She said, 9. I said, she's 9 years old. And we gave her birthday. It was June 26th. And I said, is there anything else she needs? And he said, well, how do I put her into grade 3 when she's never been in school before? And I said, well, I understand that a lot of your teachers are poor, so I would like to pay one of them extra to give her extra lessons. So we got Mercy into school, and John and I eventually came back to Canada. When we returned to Zambia, I went to the school to check on Mercy, and I found out that as soon as I left the country, that guardian sold everything, her socks, her shoes, her uniform, and they put Mercy out of the house. I was devastated. I thought, you know what? I've ruined her life. At least then she had shelter, and now she has nothing. So I went hunting for her. I just searched all the compounds and went asking, and I found that she was living in a room the size of a double bed with two uncles who were not being very nice to her. And I said, she saw me running, and she says, have you come to take me back to school? I said, no, Merce, I've come to take you home. So I want to show you what love and prayer can do. Because this is Mercy shortly after. Now, Mercy was a bit older, so she really understood. She still understands where she came from. I remember one day she was watching the movie Joseph, and I was in the kitchen. She comes running in. She said, Mommy, Mommy, you have to go get Joseph. She says, his brothers are so mean to him. They put him in a hole in the ground. You need to go and bring him to Buseko where he'll be safe. And I thought, who's she? I said, where is he? Who is he? She goes, in the television set, Joseph. But what really touched me is that she saw our home as a home of safety and refuge. You know, another time I picked her up at school, and she said, we're driving home, and she said, this boy asked me, told me today that I should give him my lunch. And I said, did you give him your lunch? And she said, no. And my heart dropped. I said, you didn't give him your lunch? He said white people gave me this lunch, that I could always get another one, that I should give him my lunch. And I told him, white people never gave me this lunch, that God did. And if God would do it for me, he would surely do it for him. So I made him get on his knees, and I prayed a prayer of provision over his life. I said, that's my girl. But you know, Mercy is just an amazing girl who loves God. You know, we have a missions team at Grace Academy that goes out into the rural areas and shares the gospel. She's also on the worship team. She just loves God, and she is also my daughter's best friend. And my daughter got married on June 4th, and she said, Mom, I'm not getting married without Mercy being a bridesmaid. And I said to John, how are we going to fix this? There's no way they're going to give her a visa into Canada. So we decided that, she said, well, I'll get married in Zambia. So I said, okay, that's okay. But when we started to do the numbers, we have 8 children. We thought, you're not getting married in Zambia because we can't afford for our whole family to go. So in Zambia, I actually had a bridesmaid's dress made for her and got the same floral bouquet. And I rented a church in town, and I videotaped her coming down the aisle to no music. And when Kara got married, she was the first bridesmaid that came down when the music started, and she was up. She was a video bridesmaid. So this is Mercy now in her bridesmaid's dress. So you can see she's turned into a lovely lady. And I said to Mercy about a year ago, I said, Mercy, you know what? John and I were thinking of adopting another child. And I said, Merce, would you like to be adopted? And she looked at me and she said, I don't know. She said, only if my life would bring more glory to God in Canada than it would here in Zambia. She goes, so I don't think so. That amazing, that's how much she loves God. But our ministry just isn't to our kids, it's to our staff. We have 63 staff. And every child that gets admitted, we actually go and investigate their stories fully, so that because there's so much deception, because people want you to help them. So we thought, you know, we investigate everyone. And so we had these two kids come in, Mwape and Esfrida. And so I thought, yeah, I need to go meet their grandmother. So I went to see the grandma, and the grandma was a nun who had an affair with the priest and became pregnant. And so the Catholic Church, they kicked him out of the church. And then shortly after that, the priest died. And this nun was so heartbroken. She just said God had punished her. She really believed the death of the priest was on her shoulders because of what she had done. At the age of she raised her daughter, and at the age of 21, her daughter had 2 children, Esfrida and Mwape, and then she died, leaving the grandma the 2 grandchildren. You can see the anguish in her face. You know, I've never met anyone so beaten down. And it was so wonderful to go into her home and tell her that we serve a God of redemption, that God loves her and wants her to have a life of victory, that God forgives her. And so, you know what, we led her to the Lord, and now she's being discipled, and we are actually hired her as a caregiver at Buseco. So right now, before she can actually work with us, you know, we want her to be strong. We want her to, you know, to be able to raise our kids, or all of our staff are Christians. So we want to make sure that, you know, she's strong. So we want to take care of her and love on her first. So she's actually just being discipled now, and then she'll come on as staff shortly. Our teams are a real blessing to the ministry. This is a dental team that came, and they did all of our kids' teeth. I have to tell you a funny story. Last time they went, there was Dr. Bill also does some oral surgery, and he came, and he was finished all of our kids. So he said, well, you know what? I don't want to waste a day. He goes, let's go help other people. So we took our pickup truck, which is a big, what is it, half ton, and we flatbed, and we went into one of the villages or compounds, and we loaded it up. There's like kids follow you, so we literally lined up rows and rows and rows of children, and they all stood there with their mouths open. If they got a pat on the head, they got to go in the back of the pickup truck. They had no idea. We had no idea where their parents were. They just tapped them on the head and they got in the pickup truck. They had no idea where they were going. So we loaded up the pickup truck, and when they got there, they all got brand new clothes. They got a soccer ball. But there was one boy in particular who had no front teeth, none at all. And Dr. Bill took surgically brought his teeth down, so he had front teeth. They weren't knocked out. They just never came down. So he surgically brought his teeth down. I thought, can you imagine at his house tonight when his mother gets home from the field? And he smiles, and he's got front teeth, and he's got these new clothes on, and she says, what happened? I don't know, some white people came and put me in a pickup truck. You know, men often say, what can I do? You know, people, you know, my dad is 87 years old, and he goes every year. And he's going this November with me. And you know what he does? He loves the kids. He plays skippo by the hour with them. This man here, you can see he's got David and Davis. That's Helen's twin brothers. And he's teaching them to shave. They have lots of women in their lives, but they have very few men. So it's so good when men go and they can disciple them. I say the first thing I tell men is do a devotion with them. You know, do something practical with them. Because our kids will just soak you up like a sponge. But other than our 106 kids that live with us that call Grace home, God has really increased our territory. He says if you're faithful in the small things, that he will increase. And so I was in the children's hospital, and one of the nurses said to me, Susan, do you ever take paralyzed children? And I said, no. And she said, would you? And I said, I don't think so. She said, well, you know, did you hear that mom crying in the background? She said, we have a 10-year-old girl named Prudence, and she's paralyzed. She's dying from cancer, and she lives in a mud hut with no running water, no electricity. The little girl doesn't have a bed. She sleeps on a sack, like a potato sack, and the mother is crying because she was just discharged, and the mom is saying, how am I going to care for her? How can I possibly care for her? She has bed sores all the way down to her bone. How am I going to care for her? So I said, of course, we'll take her. So we took Prudence in, and she stayed with us for 2 months with her mom. We have a clinic, and we made a room into a hospice, and we put two beds, one for her mom and one for her. And we were able to love on her, and our kids went in and read to her until the Lord took Prudence home. And we just find it's such a gift from God. It's like the ministry came full circle, because when we first started, that was the vision, to hold kids till Jesus took them home because there were no ARV drugs. And now John and I are going back to Zambia in August, and we have meetings set up with the hospital so that we can now have one area of our clinic as a hospice for dying children. The needs in Zambia are great. We met this girl in the adult hospital. She had a toothache, and she was here for ages. She was in the hospital for months. And I said to her, so why are you still here? Like, what are they doing for you? She said, the hospital has no medication for me, and they're not able to do the surgery that I need. They said I had to go to Lusaka, which is the capital. And I said, so why are you still here? She goes, I have no money to get to Lusaka. So we were able to give her the money from our widow's jar fund and be able to send this young lady, 21 years old, to Lusaka for the surgery. However, she died 2 days after getting to Lusaka. This is Maureen. Maureen is 8 years old, and we found her in Children's Hospital, and she was just sitting on a plastic chair in the hallway because there were too many cockroaches in her room. The Children's Hospital is very run down. They have 3 kids per bed. They don't have the medication that the children need, but most people take their kids there because they fear that they don't like their children dying at home. So I had on my team that I took that time, I had 2 nurses with me. And one of them had been trained in a burn unit nurse, and she's in a burn unit. So she said, Susan, you know, that little girl's going to die. She goes, we need to go and get special cream for her. So I said, okay. So we went into town to the chemist, and we bought the special cream, and we took it back to the hospital the following day. And she had been discharged because the hospital said there was nothing else they could do for her. So we went, looked for Maureen, and we found her in her compound, in her village. She lived in a little tiny mud hut that was about 8 by 10, and she was in a bucket of water that was filthy dirty. Right away, that nurse started to cry, and she said, Susan, she's not going to make it. And she was trying to explain to me how important it was that burn victims have a sterile environment. She goes, I can't think of anything worse for this child than to be in a mud hut. And they were all open wounds. So I begged the mother, and I said, do you think we could take Maureen back to our clinic where she could be cared for? And the mother refused, but as I looked, my team was standing in a circle, holding hands, praying. And it was shortly after that the mother agreed to let us take Maureen. Maureen has since had 2 plastic surgeries. We've sent her to Lusaka. And you can see she's had one on her forehead and her cheek. And last Monday, she had her new eye. Her burns took off her eyelids, so she couldn't close her eyes, and they were afraid that she would lose her sight. But she now has eyelids and can close her eyes. And in September, she's going for a final surgery on her neck. We also tested Maureen. She's also HIV positive. So the parents have agreed that they will actually let us keep Maureen forever. So because for Maureen, a life in Zambia would mean a life of begging and poverty. She would not have a good life. This way, she'll always have someone to love her, and she'll always have family. And this is George, and I met George on my last trip. He'd been sitting in that chair for weeks. Can you imagine weeks? He came from a very long distance with his son, who has a cleft palate. And I wrote John and I said, John, I met this guy in the hospital. He had traveled so far. He has no money. He has $2 on him. He has no money for food. He's still in the same clothes that he's been wearing for weeks. And the baby's malnourished because he can't drink, and they don't have any formula in the hospital. They just feed them this porridge stuff. And so I said, is there any money in the widow's jar that we can help this baby? And John said, don't worry about it, Susan. Just make sure that baby and that dad gets taken care of. So we brought the dad food, gave him money for food for the next month, and then we brought him a blanket and a pillow and some change of clothes, and we brought some clothes for the baby and some formula. But the best thing that happened was that we contacted a mission hospital in Lusaka that is going to treat the baby for free, and the dad actually gets to stay with him in a bed, and that child's going to have the life-saving surgery that he needs. We also have a grandma program now. So you can see our ministry is really growing from not just taking care of our 106 kids, but growing to the community. This is a grandma who, my generation, a lot of them are gone to HIV, TB, and malaria. So this grandma has 6 kids, and they've all passed away, and she has all her grandchildren. So now we have a grandma program that we give them food every month. This grandma comes and she gets food, money for food for her grandchildren. This is a grandma's bed, just to show you the type of poverty they live in. We run 3 feeding programs now in the villages, and we have one school in one of the villages for 389 kids. It's another one of them. I'm just going to play a brief video. Oh, so this video is about, you know, America's Got Talent. This is about Korea's Got Talent. And this is a boy by the name of Choi, who's 22 years old. And he was, his parents died, and he was left in an orphanage at the age of 3. And at the age of 5, he was beaten, and he ran away from that orphanage. John, this is not coming up, honey. And he ran away from that orphanage. And John said, you know, I wonder, like, can you imagine, here's a boy, how many people just pass this kid by, not seeing his potential, not seeing his talent, not seeing, he was just a beggar like all the other kids. It's not coming up, John. It's not coming up. There's an ordinary-looking guy getting ready to be on stage. I'm 22 years old, and my name is Choi Sung. I've lived in very difficult circumstances. I still feel uncomfortable challenging this competition. I just want to be like normal other people. I don't sing that well, but when I sing, I feel like I become a different person. Hello. I'm Choi Sung Bong. I'm 22 years old. By your look, I can't tell what you do for a living. I'm a manual worker. Early in the morning? Yeah. As I look into your application, you left family section blank. I was left in the orphanage when I was 3. And when I was 5, I ran away after gotten beaten by the people there. Then how did you live on since then? I sold gum or energy drinks on the street. I had that life for about 10 years. Did you stay with anyone else besides yourself? No, I was alone. So you lived by yourself since you were 5? Yes. I've lived that way for 10 years. I slept on stairs or public toilets. For 10 years, like a day fly. Did you go to school? No, I took GED tests to get my elementary middle school, and high school was the first school I went to. Wow, you're unbelievable. Are you going to sing today? Yes. Do you enjoy singing? Rather, I say I sing because I enjoy it. I like singing because it was the first thing I liked after living that day fly life. I'm not a good singer, but I just like it. Let me hear you sing. You know, Choi is not alone. There's literally millions of children like him. There are 1 million orphans alone just in Zambia. You know, the government of Zambia can't even control the amount of orphans there are. Around the city of Ndola, where we are, there's 7 shanty slums. They say there's 50,000 people living in each shanty slum and 4,000 street orphans. This is the government orphanage. This is how they sleep. You know what? The kids just lay on mats next to each other. You can see they have no blankets, no pillows. The need is so great. Most of the people live in these compounds or shanty slums in a mud hut. No running water, no electricity. Like I said, less than 50% of children get to go to school. So they do child labor. They are the ones that haul water. They sell fritters. They walk around the market like Mercy selling sweet potatoes. But that boy Choi is not alone. There are so many. As I walked through the compound, I said to John once, I wonder how many Olympians are lost in the masses here. I wonder how many doctors they will never know they have. How many evangelists, how many preachers. How many children are lost because of poverty. So we're just so thankful for churches like yours, for the people that that are helping, both Samaritan's Purse and other organizations like ours, helping us find the choice, helping us give future to kids that would just be lost. Because it really does take all God's children working together as the body of Christ to give hope to other children, to other lost people. So thank you. If you'd like to sponsor, people often ask how can they help our ministry. If you'd like to sponsor a child with us, we'll be in the back. It's $30 a month, and every 3 months you get an update on your child. So if you have any questions, you can see us in the back. Thank you for allowing us to come and share this morning.